Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Now, today, I'm joined on the line by Tim Robey, film critic for the Daily Telegraph, who, along with the rest of the film industry, has temporarily relocated to the French Riviera for this year's Cannes Film Festival. He'll be talking to me about a handful of films on show this year, including Carol, Son of Saul, Sicario, all of which are in the running for the coveted Palme d'Or. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the show, Tim. What's the mood like on the Croisette this year?
I would say winding down. You usually find come the kind of Thursday of the second week. A lot of the industry have decamped, gone back home. Most of the press are still here because there are films still screening until the weekend, and there are still competition films screening until the Saturday morning. But, yeah, things thin out, and it becomes a bit easier to get around. You're not fighting your way for space on the Croisette in between each screening.
But generally, has there been a little bit of frisson, some surprises, cinematic excitement on the Riviera?
Yeah, there was a bit of an event because they premiered, out of competition, this was the new Gaspar Noé film, Love, which everyone knew was going to be a big talking point because it's unbelievably explicit. Hmm. Basically 3D hardcore sex film. And they screened this at a quarter past midnight last night, and the queue to get in started at sort of 10:30, basically. And it was it was quite a nice queue, and unusual for Cannes queues, in that it was everyone was lumped in together. It was a free for all. All the different badges and hierarchies of Cannes attendees and the ticket holders and press and industry and everyone. It was just first come, first served. So it was fun in that queue chatting to everyone beforehand.
Oh, well, nice to have that kind of Cannes entree to a film. But let's get down and talk to some of the films in competition that you've seen. We're going to begin with Carol. Now, this is Todd Haynes' interpretation of Patricia Highsmith's 1952 semi-autobiographical novel, The Prince of Salt. And it stars Rooney Mara as a young department store clerk who falls in love with Carol, an older married woman played by Kate Blanchett. Now, both actresses have been praised for their roles. Tim, do you think deservedly so?
Very much so. This was my most anticipated film of Cannes, and it's just so refreshing to sit down and watch it and find it exceeding even your expectations. Hmm. I do think as a team to tackle this book, which is a great underground classic of lesbian literature, Todd Haynes is just the absolute perfect director to do it justice, because there's such a kind of melancholy and an unhappiness to the story. And I think what Todd Haynes has done in the past in films like Far From Heaven and Safe, what he does on screen is he makes unhappiness beautiful. Hmm. And the other thing is that this project, as a film adaptation, has been in the works for an awfully long time. The screenwriter is a playwright called Phyllis Nage, and she wrote her first draft of this script 19 years ago. She's been struggling to get it made ever since, and you know, things with the industry are such that it's not that easy to get a lesbian love story made with the right cast at the right time, and with the right budget. But it's just come together at the perfect moment, I think. And both those actors, Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, are just impeccably excellent in these roles.
Well, let's hear a clip from the film. This is Carol with Rooney Mara's character Teresa having lunch together.
What do you do on Sundays?
Oh, nothing in particular. What do you do?
Oh, nothing lately. Maybe you'd like to come visit me sometime. You're welcome to. At least there's some pretty country around where I live. Would you like to come visit me this Sunday?
Yes.
What a strange girl you are.
Why?
Flung out of space.
Now, Tim, in that clip, you can even hear the 50s styling. Tell us a little bit about the look of this film.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the most kind of perfect weighting of design, production design, costumes, and the cinematography to convey a period flavor, a very specific period look, but also a period mood. It's just one of the most exquisite films you can think of. It's absolutely spot on. Sandy Powell does a wonderful job with the costumes. Actually, this year she's already put Cate Blanchett in wonderful frocks for the Cinderella film that Kenneth Branagh made, but now she's outdone herself, I think, with this. And the cinematographer is Ed Lachman, who's worked with Todd Haynes before, and who is just an absolute genius. I mean, the film is kind of, every shot is frameable, I think. It's one of those things. Every shot you could hang on the wall. I think Todd Haynes is very influenced by, Edward Hopper, and the film recalls the mood of a lot of Hopper paintings. You know, you think of those paintings with, you know, slightly sad-looking figures sitting on the edge of hotel beds or in kind of desolate diners late at night waiting for someone to arrive. That's the kind of melancholy we get. And again, the script, I think, does beautiful things with Highsmith. The end of that clip we just heard has one of the most famous lines she ever wrote, "What a strange girl you are, flung out of space." And we hear this twice. Phyllis Nage picks up on that line because it's so key. But she hasn't used that much of Highsmith's dialogue. She's actually managed to find an adaptation path through the book, which allows her to come up with her own wordplay, really. She's a wonderful playwright. And there are so many lines she's written which have kind of double meanings, innuendos, and they kind of hang in the air and suggest things without kind of speaking them outright.
The dialogue does seem very clipped in a very 50s way. And some of the reviews coming out of Cannes have said it lacks emotion. Did you find this?
I totally disagree with that, actually. I think the thing with the film is that it uses restraint to hold in the emotion. And then at the end, it comes forth. It comes forth through the expressiveness of kind of the camera movement and stuff, but also the performances. I think what you've got to understand is that this is an era of real kind of repression and fear and difficulty for anyone gay to kind of come out and lead a happy life. You know, particularly for women in the 1950s in America, an extremely conservative era. And Cate Blanchett's character is a married mother who is clearly desperately unhappy, but finds this woman, finds this girl that she wants to spend her life with, and then has this horrible choice to make because her husband wields their child against her, and she's suddenly pressed into a kind of legal position where she may have to choose between, you know, custody of her own child and, being able to spend time with Therese. And I think the kind of oppression and the restraint and the constriction of that era is very, very powerfully conveyed by a film which doesn't allow emotion just to kind of flood forth in any sentimental way, but keeps things at a reserve and keeps us feeling as though we're sort of eavesdropping on their relationship from a distance. So many of the shots are kind of framed behind glass and through doors and through windows and, you know, on the other side of car doors and things like this. Everything is happening between us, and there's a layer of glass between us and the action, if you like.
Intriguing. Well, we still have a couple more days to wait to find out if it does win the Palme d'Or. But let's move on now to Son of Saul. This is a directing debut from the Hungarian Laszlo Niemes and has had rave reviews. It's set in a concentration camp in 1944. Saul, one of the prisoners, has the task of carrying out corpses from the gas chambers. One day, he discovers his dead son amongst the bodies and strives to give him a proper burial in secret. It's been described as outstanding and a Holocaust film like no other. A bit incongruous to see a film like this in the glamour setting of Cannes, is it not?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, they did give the Palme d'Or to Roman Polanski's The Pianist back in 2002, I suppose, if we're thinking about Holocaust films. But the thing that's most unusual about this is that it's a debut in competition, which has attracted some of the best reviews that we've seen here. When you see a debut in competition, you think, wow, this director must have something going for them, because you don't just jump straight into the Cannes competition with no kind of technical expertise. Laszlo Niemes was an assistant to the Hungarian director Béla Tarr. He's probably the most important Hungarian filmmaker of the last generation. But he's actually got an incredibly original point of view on this material, which is what I think strikes people. The choice of kind of camera technique that he's used is extremely striking and very kind of consistent across the film. He uses a very, very, very shallow depth of field. So we're looking mainly at the face of the main character, played in this kind of extraordinary, if very, very monotonous, very kind of very, very drained performance by a guy called Geza Rohrig. We're usually looking at him in tight close-up, and then around him, the horrors that he's having to confront, you know, the cleanup of this extermination in the gas chambers, are visible but blurred. You know, we don't see them in focus. We see them in the distant background of the shot, out of focus. We're guessing at exactly what we're seeing. And it's as if he has sort of, he's managed to kind of veil himself from the atrocities.
Well, let's get a sense of this cinematic atmosphere created by this director by listening to this clip now.
Nie bądź sobie wiele wiód. Chodź, o idzie.
Mam. Raus. Rokonot. Akkor is. Nincs rá szükséged.
De a főnökének van.
The sound of Son of Saul in competition at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Now, Tim, do you get a sense of why Neames was drawn to this subject matter? What themes is he trying to explore at this moment in time?
I mean, it's a film which I think withholds too much kind of context intellectually in terms of kind of thinking about the Holocaust. I think what he's tried to do is find a new aesthetic approach to confront it, really, to confront us with it kind of experientially. And that, you know, there have been ways of dealing with the Holocaust on film before which have kind of kept us very much at arm's length and which have, you know, have found a way of kind of sort of confronting it very obliquely. And I think he has found this very kind of moral way of dealing with it, where it is on screen there, but we're not actually being kind of thrust frontally into the carnage, if you like. We're very much viewing it from the point of view of this man who has been made to force into this choice, kind of like a Faustian pact, in that he is part of this thing called the Sonderkommando, one of the work units, who, to get a stay of execution and not suffer the same fate as his compatriots, has agreed to essentially assist in their extermination and clean up after it, which is this horrendous situation. And the kind of story that evolves is very interesting and quite ambiguous. He says that this boy that he sees being killed in front of him is his son, but there's no emotion as he says this, and we struggle to believe that it could possibly be his son. And then later in the film, other characters he knows who he confronts and speaks to about this tell him, you know, you don't have a son. They tell him you do not have a son, which he denies. And he says that, no, this is my boy, and I'm finding a rabbi to go and bury him. But we wonder, actually, if this is his child, or if in a way, that the boy is kind of a symbolic figure, and that his kind of mission in the film to get this burial achieved is somehow him kind of shouldering the weight of guilt and the burden that he has he's submitted to in all his time, as a victim of the regime.
Well, moral dilemmas, that Son of Saul. It's going to be opening in Hungary in June and will no doubt roll out in cinemas worldwide before too long. So do keep an eye out for it. Now, we're going to end with Sicario. This stars Emily Blunt as an FBI agent in Arizona who travels across the border to Mexico in pursuit of a scary drug lord. This is somewhat a recurring theme in cinema. So, Tim, what makes this film stand out?
I think it's a question of craft with this film. The director is Denis Villeneuve, who's now building a reputation for himself as quite an effective journeyman, really, a kind of craftsman who uses excellent collaborators to make films. That he's coming up with the Blade Runner sequel next. And on Prisoners, he had the great cinematographer Roger Deakins, who returns here to shoot the film. It has an extremely kind of handsome, burnished kind of quality to it. The palette is a kind of yellow, sickly, dusty thing. And the soundtrack is by a guy called Johan Johansson, who did the music for The Theory of Everything, who you could hardly come up with a more contrasting score than the one he gives us here. It's really, it kind of churns away in the low bass, and these double bass sounds kind of drag us down. The opening sequence reminded me actually of Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow's film about the assassination of Osama bin Laden, in that it has this kind of, it's filled with this weird dread, you know, this attack on a compound that Emily Blunt's involved in. You're instantly, you know, things, terrible things are going to be seen inside this place just from the sound, from the look of it, from the camera style. And I think he's done a very good job marshalling his collaborators here, and I'm going to mention the cast as well in a second.
Well, talking of that, you mentioned Emily Blunt. I'd love to hear your take on her performance.
Yes. Now, what's very interesting is that she starts this film, and you kind of think you're dealing with the sort of character that Jessica Chastain played in Zero Dark Thirty, or even Jodie Foster in The Silence of the Lambs. You know, this kind of very hard-nosed career woman working for one of the American agencies who's going to be kind of leading us through a very kind of murky path of intrigue, in this case, in the war on drugs. And the film decides, in fact, that she is, in a way, neutralized in that role by the agendas of various male characters who drag her along for the ride. She's sort of sequestered across into this mission where they go into Mexico, which is an illegal mission that the CIA are possibly supporting. And the characters played by Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro are really the ones in charge, and they're not giving her the full facts. She's there with them. She's kind of tagging along, and she's very frustrated in her kind of need to find answers and exactly what they're doing and who this cartel is that they're taking down. So it's an interesting approach, I think, because you're expecting a certain amount of kind of feminist gumption to the film, but the film's also deciding that this character is perhaps not as powerful as we think she's going to be.
A battle of drug lords and Mexico, together, that equation says violence to me.
It's certainly quite a violent film, and it's a film which doesn't revel whatsoever in the violence. There's a kind of cold dread to it, I think. In fact, there's a very key sequence in the middle of the film, which is sort of a massacre on a gridlocked flyover in Juarez near the Mexican border. And all the male characters, Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin, are involved in kind of mowing down members of this drug cartel. Just complete, almost cold-bloodedly, they get out of their cars and just, like, start spraying everywhere around them with machine gun fire, while Emily Blunt kind of cowers in a way in abject terror and bafflement in the back of this car. And the question that she then has for them is, you know, what kind of an approach is this? What kind of a procedure is this to take in the drug war? And Josh Brolin's character says to her, this is the future. You know, this is the way we have to get things done, because the kind of red tape approach is not getting us anywhere.
Well, so far a hit amongst critics at Cannes, but there will be a wait for this one, as Cesario won't start rolling out in cinemas until the autumn. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Tim Robey, thanks as ever for joining us, and do enjoy the rest of Cannes. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian Tobias. My producer was Holly Fisher, and my researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again on Monday for this week's Best Photographic Exhibitions. But for now, thanks very much for listening.